Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hey, it's Jackie Cash and welcome to the Dork Forest. Intros are hard. I have a new album. You should be listening to it. I have a new hour. You could be watching it on YouTube, but I appreciate you listening to this, The Dork Forest. You could go to JackieCasia.com or TheDorkForest.com, and you can listen to it there. You can listen to it on wherever you're listening to it right now. You can watch it on YouTube separately, and that is where Altercation is also streaming. The album is available wherever you listen to any kind of album, and it's also on Bandcamp, which has a bunch of other, some very old Dork Forest that are free on that channel. Otherwise, you should know that the Dork Forest is, I don't have a Patreon, so feel free to donate. If you have $100 a year, I would love $100 a year from everybody. You can hand me a sweaty wad of 20s when you come and see me do stand-up, or you can email me or Venmo me. The email would be PayPal, Jackie@JackieCation.com, where you can also email me. And Venmo is just @JackieCation, which is like my Instagram and my TikTok and all the things. And there's merch. There's Dork Forest merch. There's Made of Bees merch. And I don't know. There's so much stuff. I can't remember everything. You're doing vital work by listening to the Dork Short Forest, and I'm glad you are. And I hope you want to hear about somebody's dorkdom, because that's what's going to happen right now. Rangers, it's me, Jackie Cation. Remember me? Here's a scoop. This week on the Dork Forest, we have a friend of a previous guest, another Brit. Let's hear it. Tom Selinsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, Tom Selinsky, you should know. Now, I say your friend's name, who has been on this, Abgalaya. Is that correct?
That's how I say it.
Abgalaya? Okay.
Yep.
I believe I did it correctly. It's been months, and it's been a blur. So, but she was on the Dork Forest. You guys could go back, look at that one. It's a real good one. But they have a podcast together, Tom Selinsky and Abgalaya, and it's called All British Comedy Explained, which I, there's only about Max. He's you can get on the ground floor of this is what I'm saying. So because there's only like
less than a year.
Yeah. So there's like 15 or 16 out there in the world of podcasts. And then there's another maybe 15 at the Patreon and all the extra stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So it's if you go to allbritishcomedy.com or allbritishcomedyexplained.com.
AllBritishComedy.com.
There we go. We spent 5 minutes, me writing all this down. All British Comedy. It'll be in the notes. That's the good news.
And so, Google.
Right. And Google, these people know how to use the internet. The Instagram is @BritishComedyPod, AllBritishComedy.com, Tom Selinsky, Abgalaya. Let's talk. But here's the thing. You're going to talk about something. I've never seen it, which is weird.
Okay.
Because I am age appropriate for to have seen it. Slightly younger, but it's Red Dwarf, which is a science fiction comedy show, right?
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Science fiction and comedy.
Yeah.
British.
Yeah, it's a weird hybrid. I think it was widely thought after Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that that was going to be the last word. The crucial difference... I will just launch straight in here. Why not? Is that Arthur Dent, the hero of Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is comfortably middle class. As you know, Jackie, in Britain, we're obsessed with class, especially where comedy is concerned. It's all about class. And so Arthur Dent is tramping around spaceships in a dressing gown, whining about not being able to get any tea.
Right.
And it's incredibly funny, obviously. It's brilliantly written.
It's a Douglas delight. Adams
was a genius. But Rob Grant and Doug Naylor came from Manchester, and they had much more working class origins. And they were interested in a much more gritty working class style of comedy. So they were influenced by Alien, which is like Truckers in Space.
The movie Alien?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Truckers in Space, by the way, is a board game. Go ahead.
Oh, is it? I didn't know that.
Yes.
And its antecedent. Do you know Dark Star?
I have heard of Dark Star. I have never seen that.
It's a ramshackle film. John Carpenter, I think it is. John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon, who went on to have terrific careers, who made it together when they were film students. And they then were given some money to turn it into a feature. And I think it's John Carpenter says, what happened was we started with the world's best student film and ended up with the world's worst professional feature. but it's delightful. Yeah. So they were really influenced by that. And they're like, we want to get something like this on television. And they were starting to get pretty good careers as television comedy writers. But okay. If you think that now a pitch about space bums 3 million years from Earth would be a tough sell, then it was also a tough sell in the mid-1980s.
Right, but they did have the precursor of the Hitchhiker success and the Star Wars success and the whatever. Like, there was some success, so they were allowed to make it. When was the first season?
Allowed is a strong word. So they had the idea in the mid-80s. They'd had a successful radio comedy sketch show, and Red Dwarf is sort of an evolution of one of the sketches in that. They'd been writing for other comedians like Jasper Carrot, of whom you probably have never heard.
It's true.
And they were core writers on Spitting Image, which you might have heard of.
Nope.
Spitting Image was a satirical puppet show, which ran for something like 15 years. These amazing caricatures of politicians and celebrities and so on. They were drafted in to save it when halfway through the first series, it was getting terrible ratings and everyone thought it was awful. And they were parachuted in to punch up the writing. And they succeeded because then it ran for like 15 years.
Okay. It sounds amazing. A puppet show that's also sort of a satirical, like, weekly news satire?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they would do, like, 12 episodes a year. It wasn't a year-round production because it was too expensive.
Oh, right.
But
hard to write, I bet. So
exactly, yeah.
To get it done. But they did it correctly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they had this idea that they would write about this mechanic who was at the bottom of the totem pole on this mining ship that was exploring space. There'd be an accident. He would be, by a fluke, in suspended animation. And the ship's computer, because of the radiation leak, would have to get the ship as far away from Earth as possible. And so he would be revived 3 million years later to discover his only companions are the computer, a hologram simulation of his dead bunkmate, who is the most annoying man in the world, and a creature that evolved from the ship's cat.
Oh, my Christ. Why have I not seen all of this?
So this is absolutely bonkers.
Right, but this is gold.
Yeah.
This is, no wonder people love this show. Yeah. How have I, okay.
So they took it to the BBC, who immediately rejected it. because the thinking was that a situation comedy was about nice middle class people sitting on sofas in front of French windows, and middle England wasn't going to accept anything else, certainly not whatever this was.
Because was it supposed to be 30 minutes? Is that how long?
Yeah, exactly. It was pitched as a 30-minute comedy in front of a studio audience, like shot like Fawlty Towers or Yes Minister or any one of these. But,
oh my God.
It's the setup is two men who hate each other but can't get away. Which is a staple of British sitcoms. It's Steptoe and Son. It's Porridge. It's all of these shows.
Okay. And it's The Odd Couple. Okay.
It's The Odd Couple. Exactly right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So you have finickety, career-obsessed Rimmer, who is second to the bottom of the hierarchy, and then slobbish, easygoing Lister, who is right at the bottom of the hierarchy, but one of them's now a hologram recreation.
And the other one's alive. So can he, but he can't turn him off?
He could.
I mean,
but
it would make the show, it would make the show incredibly short.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
There's an episode, the sixth episode of the first series is called Me Squared, where Rimmer discovers that he can eke enough power out of the ship's computer to create a second hologram, and so creates a second hologram of himself. but he is so obnoxious that the two Rimmers can't stand each other. And eventually, they flip a coin to see which one's going to be turned off.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, how did it get made? So the BBC rejected it. They went away and retooled the script. The BBC rejected it again. One of the writers, Rob Grant, said, you weren't anyone at the BBC if you hadn't turned down Red Dwarf. And it looked like the project was dead. But Paul Jackson, who was a very influential producer, quite early in his career, liked the project. Now, he'd worked on The Young Ones.
Okay.
And Ben Elton, who was one of the writers on The Young Ones, had got a commission for a serial that was basically a spin on Kind Hearts and Coronets, if you know that.
I don't. I don't know.
It was also the basis for a Broadway musical called A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
Okay. It's again, this is going to be a real fun drinking game for Rangers. Feel free to take a shot every time I don't know about a British television program.
Kind Hearts and Coronets.
It's usually done, by the way, when we talk about music. I didn't know who was in Fleetwood Mac. So don't, it's not you. Know in your heart. Okay. So Coronets and what was it about?
Kind Hearts and Coronets was an Ealing comedy from the late 40s. About a young man who is something like eighth in line to a dukedom and plots to murder his way to glory. And all of the members of the Dascoigne family that he murders are played by Alec Guinness. It's a beautiful film, wonderful film. So Ben Elton did a kind of spin on that with Jennifer Saunders playing multiple roles. And it was made by BBC Manchester, so it was slightly away from the mothership. And they had a little bit less oversight. And Paul Jackson produced it. But it was only ever intended as a single six-part serial, like a mini-series.
Okay, yeah.
But BBC accountants, being what they are, they just penciled in to the schedules Happy Families Season 2 for the following year. And nobody was interested in making Happy Families Season 2. But suddenly what that meant was Paul Jackson had a little pot of money at BBC Manchester for him to do whatever he liked. So he got on the phone to Rob Grant and Doug Naylor and said, boys, I think we've got a way to make this go forward.
That
so it all happens
great.
Very much
what
on the QT.
What year was that? Yeah, yeah. What
so that
year
would have been
this?
87. Okay. 1987. And then they had to cast it. And their first thought was they wanted to get really good actors. Alan Rickman is said to have auditioned for it. Alfred Molina is said to have auditioned for it. But the character of the cat was written in the script as a smooth, very good-looking black guy. It was kind of like a bit of a riff on someone like... Little Richard or someone like that.
Okay.
And these two white guys were just a tiny bit nervous about this. Like, have they accidentally written a hate crime?
Oh, right. Yeah. There's always this thing where you want to be inclusive, but you don't want to be a dick or lame.
Yeah.
And I did a June. We have a holiday here in the United States that I'm sure Trump is trying to get rid of called Juneteenth.
Oh, yes.
And it is the celebration of the final state learning that African-Americans are no longer enslaved. And so it was this weekend, and I did a benefit Zoom for the new museum, which is going to go up in Fort Worth, Texas. And Lori Kilmartin and I, who we do a podcast about stand-up comedy, she was like, well, who do you is it just going to be us? And I was like, well, I think we should ask some black comics. And she's like, oh, they're all working. They're all working, Jackie. And I was like, we could ask. And so I asked one friend of mine who I had to rebook on something else that I'm doing. And I was like, can you do this? And she ended up being the only other comic until Marie Bamford popped in. And she is black. And she was like, what am I? Your diversity hire? And so there was, I got mocked. And I got mocked because Lori Kilmartin didn't want to get mocked. And I was like, we both could have been mocked, man. Anyway, this is also something you should know about the Dork Forest. I sometimes hijack the dorkdom and make it about me. Tom Selinsky, you guys, don't forget to see All British Comedy Explained. And when I say listen, see, I mean listen.
You can see or listen. It's also on YouTube.
Oh, it's also on YouTube. Go to allbritishcomedy.com. Now, tell me about their casting of this cat.
So they sent the script to a guy called Craig Charles, who was a mixed race performance poet from Liverpool, who'd been appearing on things like Saturday Live, which was our sort of like ripoff of Saturday Night Live, which also featured Ben Elton very heavily. and was produced by Paul Jackson. There's a lot of the same names kind of in the stew here. It's all fairly incestuous.
Classic. Yeah.
So they sent it to Craig Charles and said, like, have we done a hate crime? Is this okay? Is this character all right? And he said, yeah, I don't think this is racist at all. I think it's really cool. By the way, can I audition for Lister?
Right. Can I please? Oh, Lister. Okay.
Yeah. A swab. Good. He never really done much acting before. And he remembers his girlfriend wishing him good luck, like sending him out the door to go to this audition, saying, by the way, you won't get it. You can't act and you're not funny.
Love is in the air.
Yeah. And there's a bit of a kind of Manchester-Liverpool rivalry as well. So these two writers are from Manchester, and they were like, they'd imagined someone a little bit like Reverend Jim from Taxi, played by Christopher Lloyd. Like this kind of guy is a bit like spaced out. And what they were getting from Craig Charles was nothing like what they imagined. Certainly they didn't imagine a Liverpool Scally playing this part, but he was so kind of warm and charming. And they thought, we think we might be onto something here. There was a deadpan comedian called Norman Lovett, who they thought would be perfect for the ship's computer, Holly.
Right.
A dancer called Danny John Jules, who just slayed the part of Cat. Apparently, he didn't realize he was 40 minutes late for his audition and swaggered in confidently regardless. And they thought, oh, he's the guy.
Good for him.
And then someone else who hadn't done much acting, but was a popular impressionist. He'd also done voices of Spitting Image. He'd been on Saturday Live as well. His father had been in the military, and he seemed to understand the character of Rimmer. So they'd intended to find really good actors to play all these parts. What they'd end up with was a stand-up comedian, a dancer, a performance poet, and an impressionist.
That is awesome. That's because you guys have so many great actors, and you had such a machine that was churning out these amazing actors. The fact that a bunch of just normal performers who did not go through that system got to be on something, that's amazing. And I like that. I like that the casting ended up being like, you know, more diverse. And I think it makes it less of a mess, less stark if there's more diversity in the actual human or, you know, other people.
Yeah. I mean, it's four dudes, but certainly from a race perspective, it is noteworthy. It would have been, I think, even more unusual on British television than on American television in the late 80s to have a cast of four, two of whom were not white. And especially when it's not really a plot point. Now, like I said,
Really addressed.
There's
just the cat happens to just be a very charming young man.
Yeah, exactly. I have this is the book I wrote, and so you can see this is actually there's a later addition to the regular cast. This is the robot Crichton, who wasn't in the first two series, but that's the cat there, and that's Rimmer, and that's Lister.
Okay, so go to the YouTube, and you can see. Tom Selesky wrote a book, you guys. Congratulations.
Yes.
I have always wanted to have written a book. Anyway.
It's good fun having written a book.
Writing a book. Yes. Sounds like a real chore.
Douglas Adams again said, writing is easy. You just stare at a blank page until your forehead bleeds.
I got to hear him speak once. Did not get to see him because it was so packed. Oh. It was he was at a bookstore in Minneapolis, and the book that we went to see, my nephew and I, to see him read from was Last Chance to See.
Oh, I love
that
book.
It was his book about endangered species. It was beautiful and very funny, but also very sad and very funny and very beautiful. Okay, so it's 1987. These four men have been booked.
Yep.
Now, how many episodes per series are there?
So it's Britain. So they were commissioned for six episodes. The plan was they would rehearse during the week in London. The BBC had a set of rehearsal rooms in Acton. And then on Friday night, they'd go up to Manchester, to the BBC's Oxford Road studio, because it was being paid for by BBC Manchester, and record the show there. But on the eve of the first recording came the news that there was a BBC electricians strike. And so the recording was cancelled. So now they had a bit of a tricky decision, because do you spend the next week re-rehearsing episode one and then put that on? Or do you just move on to episode two and you hope to pick up episode one later. So they elected to rehearse episode two, but by the end of the second rehearsal week, the strike was still going on, so they couldn't record episode two either. Now, accounts slightly differ about this, but it seems if they rehearsed at least five, if not all six, and didn't record anything. What? So by this point, it's clear the project is dead.
Yeah.
It's absolutely dead. But there was a guy at BBC Manchester called Peter Ridsdale Scott who championed the project. And when it became clear that that they weren't going to get anything, he and Paul Jackson arranged for a couple of BBC brass to come in and sit on some rehearsals so they could see how well the cast was gelling. And Peter Ridsdale Scott quietly arranged for all the sets to be put into storage rather than destroyed. And then over about the next 3 months, Peter Ridsdale Scott and Paul Jackson lobbied and lobbied and lobbied and basically persuaded the BBC to remount the show.
Oh, my goodness. That, you know, there's so much shenanigans that has to go on. If there's like one problem, there's like a bunch of suits who are just like, well, it's fine. We'll just do something else.
Yeah.
We'll rebuild from the beginning. And you're like, no, you like this. I promise you.
You, yeah. And, you've like paid for these six scripts. Where are you going to get another show cheaper than this?
Right. They're already, no kidding. So when did they get to do them?
So finally, it went out in February of 1988. Could they just
knock them out because they had rehearsed the hell out of them?
I mean, I think that extra week helped. Although actually, Paul Jackson, I think, had suspected that this was going to be a difficult show, certainly from a technical point of view. And he quietly arranged, maybe he was also spooked by the strike business. So he'd booked a seventh recording slot. So they had seven weeks to record six episodes. And so they used that seventh week for pickups. And in particular, nobody was happy with episode one. So this is even after it's been written and rewritten. They have this double rehearsal process. And they finally got in front of the studio audience. But first episodes are tricky, especially when you're dealing with a premise pilot, if you're familiar with that term.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, because how do you get all the information? You have to do all
So much exposition. So half of episode one was reshot in that seventh week. And then finally it was all kind of patched together. But it did perform well. It was something like, it was in the BBC Two top 10 for the week. And the BBC were happy. And it was recommissioned and they managed to get a second series out that same year.
Oh, wow. Just because they could. They had, and I bet you giving it that much time, the cast, you know, then gets to know each other and becomes more of a team than if they had just done. It's weird. I mean, it makes sense that the first episode would be redone at the end, kind of, just because they know what they're doing then. Yeah. And what did the set look like? Was it just the inside of the thing?
So most of it is because of budget set inside the ship, and Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, they were a bit surprised because they came from Spitting Image where they were the chief writers.
Okay,
that made them the shot callers, the tastemakers. Even though it wasn't their show, they were kind of having the last word. On Red Dwarf, which was a show that they'd created from the ground up, they suddenly found themselves demoted to just the writers with a producer and a director sitting over them making decisions that sometimes they approved of and sometimes they didn't. And in particular, they had an opportunity to talk to the designer about Alien and Dark Star and how it should feel a bit like a spaceship. And then they were slightly dismayed to walk onto the set to discover that everything was gray.
Right. If I remember correctly, that was what kind of put me off of that first episode, was that there was no contrast.
Yeah.
It kind of sucked into itself. And I was like, where are the people? Where are the, you know, it's just like a blur. Did they ever fix it?
Yeah. So by slow degrees, from the third series onwards, when there was a different designer, it starts to become a bit more colorful. And they start having a bigger budget. They start being able to go on location more. And they introduce this new character, Crichton. So now they have, because they realize they have only two corporeal characters, because the hologram can't be in mortal danger. And one of them, the cat, doesn't really care about anything. So having the robot as well meant, okay, now we have a little bit more. And then what happened was they realized that the robot and the computer are both sort of doing the same job. And the robot's more fun. So eventually they write the computer out as well. So you come down to this core group of four by the end of the sixth series.
Okay. So they've doubled up for like two or three years.
Yeah.
Two or three seasons. Okay. But the computer was named Holly.
Yes.
So there was an opportunity there to book a woman. And they said,
funny you should say that. So the end of the second series is an episode called Parallel Universe, where the ship finds itself looking at an identical copy, but they're in a parallel universe where the sexes are reversed. So this is one of those things I always think is great fun in sitcoms. So they got four new actors to play female versions of all of the characters, with the exception of Kat. So Kat, from the very beginning, had been desperate to find a female cat to have sex with. But the equivalent of Kat in this female world, instead of being a sexy female cat, is a male dog.
And the dog has not evolved. They have just kept breeding the dog to make sure the dog stays a dog. Yeah.
It's a similar thing. It's a man in a dog suit. So it's like an evolved dog that can talk.
Okay.
But still not what Kat was hoping for.
So the cat talks.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I did that. I was like, the cat didn't care. So I was like, oh, it's still a cat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So but it's a cat that can talk. Who doesn't?
He's in beautiful suits, which he's always grooming. He does these sort of James Brown squeals.
He walks
down corridors with a little spray going, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine.
Yeah, I've really dropped the ball never watching this. But now just think how great it could be that I have this to look forward to.
Absolutely. Okay. Anyway, so they had another stand-up comedian called Hattie Heyridge, who was the female version of Holly. Then when they were booking things for the third series, Norman Lovett, who'd played Holly, had moved to Edinburgh. And he was unwilling to commute all the way down to London for a week of rehearsals, given that it's only his face that's seen. And he said, like, I can learn the lines and you can rehearse with someone else and I'll come in and just do it on the day. And Paul Jackson said,
how far is this drive? Yeah, how far is this drive?
It's about 4.5 hours on a train, maybe 6 or 7 hours in a car. I mean,
okay, so it's a full day.
To quote Bill Bryson, that's a journey that the average American would go on to buy a taco.
Right.
But for British people, it's a journey.
I have to cross. Am I crossing borders? What's happening?
Exactly.
Would they have put him up? I mean, they would have put him up.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. But no, he was being difficult. Paul Jackson was being difficult. I don't think anyone covers themselves in glory. But the upshot was that the part was recast with Hattie Heyridge. Norman Lovett wasn't especially kind about this because he'd helped Hattie to do a kind of female version of him. He'd lent her VHS tapes of the second series so that she could see his performance.
Okay.
And then when he was replaced by her, he complained, she's ripping me off. Yeah, mate, that's the job she was hired to do and that you coached her to do.
Right. So don't be a pill about it.
Exactly.
And just get on a train.
Yeah.
And there's nothing easier than a train, by the way. And if you have TV money, which I mean, in the 80s, I don't know what BBC TV money looks like, but
you couldn't retire on it.
No, but you could probably bump yourself up from coach.
Yeah, exactly.
So you could have got a free cup of tea and a sandwich on that 4.5 journey. So not a lot of sympathy for Norman on this one right here. So how many series was he on?
Just two.
He was on the first two, and then did she cover the last
three with Hattie Heyridge, so the story out of this gets a bit complicated. Those first six are kind of seen as the glory years. Some people think the first two are, which are lower budgeted, less ambitious, don't have Robert Llewellyn as Crichton, aren't as good. Some people think they're the very best because they're the purest. But definitely those first six are seen as that's the real stuff. And they were kind of banged out, six series in 5 years, bang, 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 36 episodes. And they're all kind of middling to fantastic. in my view.
And they're all about 30 minutes still?
Yeah, exactly. They're all 30-minute, half hours, mainly in front of an audience, except where technical challenges made that impossible. So there's one episode where they figure out that they can body swap. So they can put a different personality into the hologram, and the hologram personality can go in. So Rimmer and Lister swap bodies, and that means that Rimmer can enjoy pleasures of the flesh. He can eat, he can smoke cigars, he can feel. What he promises Lister is he's going to put his body on a training regimen and get him into shape. What he's actually doing is indulging himself in all manner of ways.
Right, right, because he has not been human in a long
time. Yeah. But the way they did this for the audience was, what we see is Chris Barry. What we hear is Craig Charles.
I get it.
So that was impossible to do in front of an audience. All that had to be pre-taped and then shown to an audience to get their laughter afterwards. But mainly it was done in front of the audience.
Yeah, this sounds wonderful. Yeah. This genuinely, okay.
So then it goes off the air for a couple of years, and various things happen in the interim. The writing partnership of Rob Grant and Doug Naylor dissolves. Nobody seems entirely sure why. Chris Barry had another sitcom and was overworked and said if it did come back, he wouldn't do the full run.
Okay.
Craig Charles was in prison. And that's a story for a whole other day.
Okay, if we have time, I would like to hear the Craig Charles. Did he do it? Was he, a jury found him guilty.
He was in prison on remand, and he was eventually found not guilty.
See? I knew that there was a good... Actually, we have a half an hour. tell me the Craig Charles story.
I don't know the ins and outs, but he and another man were accused of rape.
Okay, and then they were acquitted, acquitted.
But he was kept in prison awaiting trial, which he thought was unfair.
And racist, possibly.
And who could say? Yeah.
Who could say? And the he did. He could probably say. And then the other guy, was that guy white?
I don't know. I've never thought to ask. I generally have no idea. It's all a bit of a problem. So the show
it's
comes
a little
back.
Tawdry, but the show comes so back. Is, you yeah. guys,
the show comes
and
back.
We're back.
By this stage, it's started to be shown on PBS. And Doug Naylor, who's now in sole charge of the franchise, has dreams of making it even bigger in America. And he's been told that the minimum requirement is 52 episodes. Because if you have 52 episodes, you can be in syndication for a year.
You can be in syndication, right.
Yeah. Yep. So they have 36 at the moment. And so he persuades the BBC to give him 2 seasons of 8, which will bring him up to 52.
Right.
So these are series 7 and 8, and they're not considered to be the best. So you have the problem that Chris Barry's only in 4 episodes of series 8. You have the problem that Doug Naylor is either writing the scripts on his own or bringing in other writers.
Okay.
The format starts to fray a bit. And then the 8th series kind of ditches the format altogether and almost takes us back to where we were before the series started, because... for complicated reasons we needn't detain ourselves with, an army of nanobots rebuilds Red Dwarf and all of the crew. And so we're now back on Red Dwarf as it was before the accident. But that's kind of not the show.
Right. Here's what I wanted you to say to me. They find a time travel device and Lister goes back to his family in Manchester.
Well, weirdly, they find in Liverpool. They do find a time travel device, but they only use it to go back and mess around with the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Men are ridiculous. Anyway, just thought I'd say that out loud once.
So these 7 and 8 series get great ratings because the show had been missed. People were really eager for it to come back, but fans do not rate them particularly highly, and I tend to agree with the consensus. So then it looked like the show was dead. Doug Naylor spent about 10 years trying to get a Red Dwarf movie made and came agonizingly close on several occasions, but never quite got it over the line.
It's so hard after when there's that break, like all the TV shows, by the way, absolutely none of them have I ever been into, like the X-Files or like there's a bunch of shows that ended and everyone's like, too soon.
Yeah. 6 seasons in a movie.
Right, right. So it's there's a movie, or I don't know if you ever saw Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries.
I did not.
Well, you're not missing a great deal, but it's an Australian murder mystery show based on some books. And she, it turns out, is a min-maxed character who can do everything. She can fly airplanes and speak all the languages, and she can dance, and she's fabulous looking. And it's 1929 always, but right before the crash. Anyway, so it's a glorious thing. The show itself is a murder mystery show. There's probably four or five seasons. It ends because they run out of funding in Australia. They try to make a movie. The movie blows so hard.
Yeah.
It's the worst movie. It's the plot is bad. The people are terrible. They have the same cast. Nobody cares. Anyway, so that is what often happens when something goes under and then they try to resurrect it and there's been brain damage. It's a weird analogy. But they came back. So do you know, but you don't know what happened between Rob and Doug?
No. The only thing that Rob
was it
ever
amicable?
Said,
yeah.
Well, the only thing that they ever said was it came down to musical differences.
Okay.
And Rob Grant was, I'll tell the story in order, but,
okay.
Nobody's entirely sure. They went on to do stuff on their own. In Doug Naylor's case, chiefly more Red Dwarf, because in I think it was 2008, one of the new digital channels which existed approached Doug Naylor and said, it's going to be 30 years since Red Dwarf was first on the air. How are you going to celebrate it? And they commissioned a three-part miniseries to get everybody back and make more Red Dwarf.
Oh my gosh. All right.
And this miniseries is pretty bad.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. Oh, I was hoping you were going to say that they kind of figured it out. Darn it.
Alas, no. So it's kind of a bad idea. So they were going to have essentially the four characters discover that they are just characters in a television sitcom. Which was partly to keep budget down because it meant that they could shoot much of it here in the real world instead of on expensive sets.
Right.
But a real missed opportunity here. Craig Charles was appearing as a regular character in the soap opera Coronation Street at the time.
Okay.
And they got permission to film on the Coronation Street sets, and they have Lister meeting Craig Charles. So the Lister, the character, meets Craig Charles, the actor, and nothing funny happens as a result.
That is a real shame because that is very funny.
Yeah.
And they've
potentially, yeah. And there's no studio audience, and it all gets kind of sucked into this slightly pointless Blade Runner ripoff at the end, and it doesn't work. But the audience was through the roof.
Okay.
And so they regrouped and they said, okay, people want to see this. The four actors are still really good and they're still really up for it. What if we forget about all this kind of high concept stuff and we go back to 6 half-hour episodes shot in a studio in front of an audience, and we don't worry about these great big crazy concepts. We worry about what made the show good in the first place, which was the interplay between the characters. And
okay.
They got a series of 6 commissioned, and those 6 are really good.
Oh, that's... happy ending, you guys. Oh, my gosh.
Two,
and that was, what, 2010?
Yeah, so 2 more series of 6 followed, and then a one-off special after that. And that was, I think, I have to look it up, something like 2018, something like that.
Wow.
So this is a long-ass running show. It just hasn't got all that many episodes because of all the things we've discussed. Then Rob Grant and Doug Naylor started suing each other, and everything was mired in legal conflicts.
Yes.
And then COVID...
right.
And et cetera, et cetera. And then only about a year ago, it was announced that all of those legal problems were resolved and that Rob Grant and Doug Naylor could continue to pursue Red Dwarf projects independently. And Rob Grant announced that he was publishing a book co-written with another comedy writer, Andrew Marshall, which would look at Lister and Rimmer's early life. And then Rob Grant died.
Aww.
Yeah.
Happy ending.
That's why we'll never know. Yeah, we'll never know what, cause the split now, because certainly Doug Naylor was left somewhat in the dark.
Right. And Doug Naylor, of course, is the victor, and he gets to write history however he wants.
So he has a script for another Red Dwarf special, but it was turned down as too expensive. And so that, for the time being, Jackie, is where the story rests.
Okay. So let us go back to in those first six series. What are your, like, if someone were to start watching it now, let's not say name names, but if someone were, like myself, where would you say just start at the beginning?
Yeah, I think Crichton from series two is really good. So that's the first appearance of that robot character, though he's played by a different actor. He was only ever intended as a one-off, but that's a really great way in. The characters are really strong. Also from series three, there's an amazing episode called Marooned, which is pretty much a two-hander between Lister and Rimmer. They talked endlessly, Craig Charles and Chris Barry, about doing it as a play. Basically, they get stranded on an asteroid and only have each other for company and start revealing things they never told each other.
Oh, my God. And that's in series three?
That's in series three, Marooned. That's a great episode. My favorite episode is probably, there was a big swing, which is the last episode of, I think it's series five. Again, how spoilery do you want these to be?
It could be okay, because the thing is I will forget, or I will watch it and go, right. Oh, that's where Tom mentioned it.
So I think it's the last episode of series five is called Back to Reality. And it begins with our crew exploring a derelict undersea research base that they found. But a giant squid comes after them. And
space squid?
And seemingly kills them.
Okay.
Whereupon a game over sign flashes up on the screen, and they wake up from suspended animation and take these headsets off to discover that they've been playing a video game called Red Dwarf for the past 5 years.
Oh my God.
And their actual personalities are entirely different.
Okay. Wow. That's
fun. And I won't tell you how that resolves, but that's an incredible swing.
Yeah.
I think you'll agree.
Okay, and that's amazing.
So this is where the show really works, because on the one hand, it's got that great sitcom writing, that Odd Couple setup that we talked about,
right?
And then on the other hand, the fact that it's set in space in the future kind of means they can do these extraordinary stories. They can have these parallel universes. They can have these extraordinary things where they are playing around with social mores or satirizing elements of our society. They did set themselves some pretty stringent rules to work by. 3 million years from Earth, so there are no other humans.
Okay.
Lister is the only human. There are no aliens in this version of the universe. So they occasionally meet things like this squid or these genetically engineered life forms, but they're always things that have originated on Earth or were created by people, by humans. There are no aliens.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And then for the first two series, there was a hard and fast rule about no robots. But eventually that rule was broken.
Well, I have a lot of practical questions, of course. Like, what is he eating?
Oh, so the ship was designed for a large crew to explore space for many years. So there's plenty of food on board.
Okay. Well, that
was all preserved for 3 million years.
Okay, preserved, exactly. It's Oreos.
Yeah.
And so that's how he eats. Does he have entertainment?
Yes. I mean,
Do they address that in any of the episodes?
Yeah, they have a lot of the episodes are about them trying to entertain themselves by various means.
Okay,
and they have like TV shows they can watch and so on. One of the things I track in my book, which is just to show off really, all the references which are very much of the time the show was written, rather than having anything to do with being in the future. And in particular, all the things that Kat seems to be aware of, which doesn't really make any sense. There's a very famous exchange. I think it's early in season two, where Lister and Kat are just both talking about the Flintstones.
Okay.
Which of the two women, Betty or
Wilma,
is the more attractive?
Excellent.
Cat muses, I'd go with Betty, but I'd be thinking of Wilma.
Okay.
And then they both go, this is insane. This is an insane conversation. What are we even talking about? She'll never leave Fred and we know it.
Do they have a mission?
Early on, the mission is to get back to Earth. In Series 7, the mission is for Lister to find a reliable supply of Indian food, which is his staple diet. a lot of the time, they are just like they come across an asteroid or they come across a derelict space station and they investigate and they find an adventure or they find somebody to talk to or they find somebody who's going to try and kill them.
There's no other people. There's no aliens, but they might run into a space squid or a
robot or something like that.
Or a robot or some sort of a pile of drones. Was there any sort of definitive? I mean, there's the Game Over episode, which is fun. And then the next episode, they address that in a way that we don't want to talk about because it might be spoilery.
Yeah, the Game Over episode resolves within itself.
Fair enough. And then does it ever resolve?
No, the continuity is all kind of screwed up. I think by the end of Series 8, Doug Naylor realized he'd kind of written himself into a corner.
Right.
And so the special, the miniseries, is never called Series 9 on screen. And then that good Series of 6 is called Series 10 explicitly on screen.
Okay.
And there is no way to get from the end of Series 8, which is a big cliffhanger ending, to the miniseries or to Series 10. But one of the few really good jokes in the miniseries is they meet a Red Dwarf fan.
Okay.
Who confidently proclaims that Series 9 is the best by miles.
Excellent. That helps. Just any acknowledgement that you've clearly made an error and you just go,
yes,
it's all right.
Yeah. So I think
you're noticed
wisely,
by the pedant that is your fan base.
Yeah. So I pick out all of the continuity gaffes in the book, but my feeling is that Rob Grant and Doug Naylor entirely sensibly, given the choice between a good story or a good joke on the one hand and preserving continuity on the other, would always opt for the good story point or the good joke, as they should.
I mean, the thing is in the end, these are stories, and the stories need to be told correctly. And it's when I write a joke, sometimes the truth suffers. Like I have exaggerated. I have a very too much info, Tom Selinsky, but my mother died when I was 8. She was 34.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The joke,
ooh,
I was 7 and she was 33. Do you know why? Because 7 is a funnier number and 33 is the age of Christ. These are inherently funnier things and thus must be addressed. And the only people who care are my father and my siblings. And my siblings don't care that much. And my father is just like, it's just weird. And I'm like, you make up all kinds of stories and you were cheating on her anyway. So you don't get a say. How about that? In other news, we're at about 47 minutes. You have 13 minutes or we can call it your choice.
Shall we talk about Obelisk Comedy Explained?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
okay.
What is it? That's the podcast, All British Comedy Explained.
So as the past 47 minutes may have demonstrated, I know a little bit about British comedy shows.
And it's not just stand-up.
No, exactly. It's mainly not. It's mainly sitcoms and sketch shows and panel shows and things.
Okay.
So Abigailiah, your previous guest, is also a regular visitor to my monthly poker game.
Okay.
And after one of these poker games, I was talking to another friend of ours, Tom Tuck, who is an excellent writer, comedian, actor, about an amazing British comedy show from the 1980s called Not the 9 o'clock News, which may or may not have heard of.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Made a star of, among other people, Rowan Atkinson.
Okay.
And I know who that we were kind of going back and forth and swapping favorite lines and so on. And Abigailiah was looking at us with mystification. Now, Abigailiah is, fair enough, from America, but she has lived in the UK for 11 years.
Right.
But it turns out it's not just not the 9 o'clock news. She hasn't seen anything.
Right.
And so she and I decided, now I must be very clear about this. This was a joint decision. This is not me shackling her to a chair while I aggressively mansplain at her. This was something right. which was mutually agreed.
She sought out the mansplaining. She was
she
like,
absolutely did.
You have the information and happen to be a man. I am yes. all ears.
Yes.
Exactly. So the only British sitcom she claims to have seen more than one episode of is Black Books, which was a vehicle for...
I've never even heard Black Books.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly. I've seen Fawlty Towers and The Thing with Judi Dench in the suburbs.
That it could be a number of shows, but I'm thinking it's probably As Time Goes By.
Yes, As Time
yeah,
Goes By.
Yeah, there we
by.
Go. Yeah.
Was
yeah.
she in other ones where she played a lady in the suburbs?
A couple, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was very much the staple, as previously discussed.
And she just kept being recast.
Yeah. So
I love Judi Dench, but there are other actresses. Okay, go ahead.
So we decided this is what we do. So we pick a different show each week. We put them out every two weeks. And we pick a different theme for each season. So the first season was about landmark shows that broke the mold, that did it differently. So we did things like Monty Python's Flying Circus. We did Victoria Wood as seen on TV. We did The Young Ones. We did I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, which was a radio is a radio show because it's still on the air, even though it started started in 1972 and it's still on the air.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then at the end of each one, so I explain how the show came to be. We sit down and watch a couple of representative episodes, which I've curated. We get Abigailiah's reaction, and then she decides whether it goes on the shelf of fame or whether it's consigned to ignominy.
Okay.
The shelf of fame only has 10 slots. Now the shelf is full. Putting something new on the shelf of fame means she has to make the decision to cast something else off.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Or you don't want to build another shelf? Come on.
I mean...
Is the earliest one 1972?
No, the earliest one we've done is Hancock's Half Hour, which was from 1954. Oh, no, the Goon Show is even just before that. The Goon Show is 1951, I think.
Okay, and these are radio plays or radio?
The Goon Show is only ever on the radio. Hancock's Half Hour, slightly weirdly, started on the radio and then transferred to TV, and the TV and radio versions overlapped for a while.
We're back with Tom Selinsky. Tom Selinsky is now telling me about his amazing podcast, which he does with Abigailiah, and it's All British Comedy Explained. And so if you go to allbritishcomedy.com, you'll get all the information, too much information, or at British Comedy Pod on Instagram. Tom, so I think we left it at why wouldn't you be? It was the earliest one that you have reviewed, which was a radio show.
That's right, yes. Yeah, so a big tradition in both of our countries of radio comedy. Lots of famous comedians who cut their teeth on radio. Obviously, radio is cheaper, so you can often get a start there. I don't know if you had this. Tony Hancock began his career as Foyle on the radio to a ventriloquist puppet.
Oh, we had Bergman. We had Candace Bergman's dad. And ventriloquism on the radio always felt like cheating to me.
Yeah, it's playing tennis with the net down.
Here's my thing. What's on the shelf right now that if she removes it is a deal breaker?
Oh, that's such a good question. Out. Let's have a look at the shelf. So the website has the current state of the shelf. I was very heartened that Yes Minister shot up to number 2. So I think that's probably quite safe. If Yes Minister were to come off, that would be very disappointing for me. A show called The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin is clinging on there at 10. I suspect that's going to go at some point because she does sometimes shuffle things around. But I was so heartened that she got The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin because it's such an odd show, but it's so what brilliant. It's a sort of, it's a funny one because actually it was based on a novel. And so it's serialized in a way that British sitcoms tend not to be, at least certainly okay. weren't in the late 1970s when this was made. And it's about a guy called Reginald Perrin, who to the outside world looks like he's having the normal life. He's commuting from the suburbs into work at Sunshine Desserts every day in his suit and talking about new flavors of ice cream and making advances towards his secretary and quietly having a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
And this builds to, and this was a reference to a famous case of an MP who actually did this. It builds to, and this isn't a spoiler because this is in the titles, him faking his own death by leaving all his clothes in a pile on the beach.
So that he could get out of it.
Exactly.
Just out of whatever he was living.
But there's a great rogues gallery of sporting characters, all with their own catchphrases, an amazing performance by a guy called John Barron as Reginald Perrin's boss, CJ, whose stock in trade is, I didn't get where I am today. So you're not a quitter, are you, Reggie? I didn't get where I am today by being a quitter. Goodbye, Reggie.
How many series is that?
Three. Though again, it's a bit more complicated than that. So there was this initial novel, which was a big success. That was bought by the BBC. They turned it into The Fallen Rides of Reginald Perrin. And then everybody wanted a second series. The writer, David Nobbs, had conceived of it as a TV show originally, but couldn't get it away. He said, I'm turning into a novel. And then when the novel was a hit, the television companies came calling. But the lead actor, an incredible man called Leonard Rossiter, who'd also at the same time was appearing in a big ITV sitcom called Rising Damp, said, I'd be very happy to come back for a second series. But I think the reason the first series was such a success is we had the ballast of the novel. So before we do a second series, you have to write a second novel.
Wow. These are some real gutsy actors.
Yeah.
This is like, I'm not taking a train 5 hours. I'd rather yeah. not.
This is my best story about Leonard Rossiter. Okay. This is on the podcast. Like I said, he was a superstar actor. He was absolutely brilliant. This was his defining role. And probably nobody could have played it better. We interviewed David Tennant on the podcast about this show because it's a favorite of his as well. And Abigail, I asked him, would you ever like to play Reginald Perrin? And he said, but what would be the point? Because I would just be impersonating Leonard Rossiter and I can't do Leonard Rossiter better than Leonard Rossiter.
Right.
But anyway, in rehearsals, David Nobbs had the temerity to express the thought to this actor that one of the lines could be said differently and would be better if said the way that he had imagined it. And Leonard Rossiter disagreed, but David Nobbs was convinced that this was the way to go. And eventually, Leonard Rossiter agreed. At the recording, the line said that way got a huge laugh. So they met up in the bar afterwards.
Right.
And David Nobbs rather smugly said, I was right about that line, wasn't I? And Leonard Rossiter said, no, David, you were wrong, and so was the audience.
That's right. No line reads, director, weirdo,
exactly.
Writer guy.
So there was a third novel and a third series, and then Leonard Rossiter died.
Oh.
And about
everyone
10
dies.
Years later,
we're so sorry.
There was an attempt to bring it back with a new story, which was all of the sporting characters and not Reginald Perrin. That didn't work.
Wow, that.
And then about 15 or so years after that, there was an attempt to remake it with a different actor called Martin Clunes and bring it up to date, and that didn't work either.
Do you think that how many episodes of the All British Comedy Explained are possible?
Well, they keep making new comedies.
Right.
So all we have to do is stay ahead of the pace.
Right. And but do you have a list of just like, if you're doing it every 2 weeks, do you have, at least another dozen? So two more series?
Yeah. I have sketched out about 10 more series, but none of those are locked. So I'd like to do a series on class. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do a series on obscurities, shows that nobody has heard of.
Oh, right, because themes.
But I think
that's right, because each.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'd like to do a series on ambition. That's probably where Red Dwarf will go. We haven't done Red Dwarf yet, but it's the shows that are much more ambitious. They're much more than four sets, six actors, and five cameras.
Basic, yeah.
So spaceships or going back in time or things like that.
Right.
And then we might even do a series on movies. We did attempt to show Abigailia a Carry On film, Carry On Cleo, and that was not an overwhelming success. That was a crossover with a podcast I used to do about movies called Best Pick.
Have you ever seen a Canadian sitcom called Slings and Arrows?
No, I haven't.
It might be a dramedy. It's about a rural, it's about a Shakespeare company.
Right.
Outside of Toronto, I think. And they do Hamlet, but their director has died. I mean, it is the weirdest.
Wow.
It is beautifully. I mean, I don't even know.
There's an amazing Victoria Wood sketch, which was in one of the two episodes that I showed Abigailia. Abigailia fell in love with Victoria Wood. She's at number one. And to quote Abigailia, good luck getting her off there. But one of the sketches in there is an amateur dramatics company putting on Hamlet. And this is the kind of pep talk from the director to the cast at the end of a rehearsal, giving notes and so on. And she says that the whole thing is just too gloomy. It might be Hamlet, but it's got to be fun.
Did you ever see a very mediocre, weird movie that I love dearly? Because it's two movies. It's called Hamlet 2. And it's with it's about a high school theater teacher who has written a play. They're going out of, they're going to have to cancel the theater program in his Tucson, Arizona high school, and he wants to do a benefit, and he has written a play called Hamlet 2, and everyone's like, everyone dies at the end of Hamlet. He's like, I've got a device. And the first half of the movie is just this weird movie about him and his horrible, his disaster of a life. The second half of the movie is the play Hamlet 2.
Yeah.
And it is a glorious production. He's got a time machine. Anyway,
that reminds me of I'll just give you one more little thing to add to your list of things to go out and watch. Ever heard of the Comic Strip Presents?
No.
So around the same time as The Young Ones, some of those same people were making these one-off films for Channel 4. They got more and more ambitious as time went by. And their crowning achievement was a film called The Strike. So this stars Alexei Sayle as a writer who's written a screenplay about his own experiences of the miners' strike in Britain in the early 80s.
Right.
And he gets bought by a big Hollywood production company who cast Al Pacino as Arthur Scargill, who was the... you could Google Arthur Scargill to see a picture. And Meryl Streep as his wife. So similarly, the first half of the film is this man watching his life's work be corrupted. There's an incredibly funny bit with the art director, I think played by Adrian Edmondson, walking through the actual town where the events took place, saying, the film's set in the 80s, but it feels like the 40s. All films do.
All films do. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yes. And then the second half is this big Hollywood machine presents Strike, starring Al Pacino. Oh. And it's incredibly funny. Even the very, very bad Al Pacino impersonation from Peter Richardson can't sink it. It's so funny. My,
that is amazing. And now, of course, we're just going into our second hour, you guys. Here's
strap in.
Did you happen to see the Thursday Murder Club Netflix production?
I didn't. It wasn't terribly well reviewed, and I wasn't a fan of the books.
Because it wasn't good. It was not well reviewed.
I suspected that might be the case.
I enjoyed the first book so much. And when Spielberg bought it, I was like, okay, that means it'll be made. When he got the cast is amazing. It's Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
It's Ben Kingsley.
Oh,
it's
none
Pierce
of your rubbish.
Brosnan. No, right. He then picked as the director the guy who did the first Harry Potter movie. So he sticks these four elderly people in a castle. with a lot of ding, 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 ding. Here's the thing. So it's Harry Potter music. Elderly people can't live at a castle. There's too many stairs. It is supposed to be a retirement community out in the middle of some grasslands with a bunch of llamas. And everything's one floor, and they drink a lot of wine. And that's the whole thing. And it is, the first book itself was just incredibly simplistic, and it was just a good time. They made the Polish contractor guy, who was essentially, in my opinion, the hero of the book, the villain. Yeah. And it made me want to murder them all and then write that book. Anyway,
the Murder Club murders.
Yes, it's the murder, how Jackie Cation murdered Chris Columbus, and maybe Richard Osman for letting it happen. But I hope he bought land. Anyway. God dang.
Yeah, when I realized people who loved the books didn't like it, I thought this is probably not going to be worth my while.
Right. It's unfortunate. It's but people who had never read the book were like, that's all right. And I'm like, yes, damned with faint praise. Yes. Because anything that those four actors are in should either be amazing or the worst.
Yeah.
Because they've been squandered. And I believe they could have called this squandered.
Yeah.
Anyway. Not a cheerful end, but Tom Selinsky, you have been amazing. This has been wonderful.
It's been fun. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being that guy. You did it. You nailed it. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?